From Public Radio International, this is The World. A co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. It's Friday, April 22nd. I'm Katie Clark. Footage out of Syria today appears to show security forces firing on protesters. Opposition activists in the country say more than 70 people were killed. Also today, Libya's Berber minority takes up arms against forces loyal to Muammar Gaddafi. And descendants of the Good Samaritan celebrate Passover the way their biblical ancestors did. Those stories still to come.
PRI's The World is brought to you by the Medtronic Foundation, assembling the country's resuscitation experts to save more lives from sudden cardiac arrest. Learn more at heartrescueproject.com. Medtronic, innovating for life.
This is The World. I'm Lisa Mullins.
And I'm Katie Clark. The protest movement in Syria has crossed a threshold. Increasing numbers of Syrians are no longer seeking just reforms. They want the downfall of the government. Today, tens of thousands of Syrians took to the streets. They called for an end to President Bashar al-Assad's 11-year rule. But security forces fired on the demonstrators, and opposition activists say that more than 70 people were killed. Amateur video posted on the internet today appeared to show protesters in the central city of Homs. We reached one of them there this afternoon. He told The World's Lisa Mullins that he saw people being shot.
Today, my heart was broken. Every time we try to gather ourselves, they attack with bullets. And we run away. We try to come back. We run away. We try to come back. Three times we did this, and we couldn't manage. 10 of Syria's youngest people were dead. The latest is 11 years old boy in the chest. You cannot imagine how furious I am.
This happened today, that the 11-year-old was shot in the area where you were?
Yes. In Baba Amr, which is 12 kilometers away from the city center of Homs, bodies and injured are thrown in the street or left in the road without being helped. Nobody can approach them. Anybody who will be approached or come near them will be shot. Either they take him to their public hospital or they take it to the military hospital. The injured will be left there, and we know that injured are left there and being tortured till they go dead. I went to every hospital and I've seen the army. They shot me. They asked me for my ID. I managed to give them an excuse that I was just looking for food. My family, my little kid was with me. He started crying. They took my ID. They took my car registration number. And then they let me off.
And what else did you see, though, when you went out around to the hospitals?
Every hospital in Homs is surrounded with the military and the Secret Service.
So give me just briefly the chronology of what happened today.
After we had Friday pray, we went out and we start looking for people who would like to go with us. We start walking for nearly 5 minutes when everything start flying around us, all bullets, live bullets. I don't know how I managed to run away and how I managed to escape. I don't know.
When the security forces shoot, are they shooting to scare or shooting to kill?
No, they are shooting to kill straight away. Heads, chests, necks, through the neck. No, to kill.
What's next? I don't know if you see yourself making any headway or not.
We love our country and we try to gather ourselves through internet, through media, etc. The mobile phones, 90% of it has been tapped. So we cannot use mobile phones. Some of the area, the mobile phones have been cut.
Where could this end?
It will end after one thing, that all our legal points that we are asking for has been accepted. all political prisoners has to be taken out. Get them out of jails now. We want our law to be free of the government. We want equality. We want freedom of rights. We want a clear living life for our children. We have suffered enough. It's enough.
That Syrian activist spoke with Lisa Mullins this afternoon from Homs. He asked that we not use his name. Security forces also shot at demonstrators in Damascus today. Amateur video posted on the internet appears to show one confrontation in the capital. We reached human rights lawyer and campaigner Haitham Mala there. He's been jailed several times for his views. He was released last month, just before the protests in Syria began. Mr. Mala says the secret police have targeted peaceful, unarmed protesters.
All the people in Syria do not carry any kind of weapon or pistol or knife or anything else, or even stones. But the regime and the police, secret police, attack them directly by gun. This is the situation in general.
And one of the big protests occurred in Damascus today, where you are. Were you able to see anything yourself personally?
There's checkpoint everywhere. No one from Damascus can go through the city. The people call me from everywhere and give me the news, and I said, because I talk to the media, so I give them the news for every side.
The Syrian government says it is listening to protesters' demands. It's pushing through reforms such as abolishing state security courts and allowing peaceful protests. Is that enough? Will that satisfy the protesters?
No, it's not enough, because they cancel the emergency case and the security court, but they change another article in the law. You see, now the police has the right to investigate for those people. Well, they call them attack the regime, attack the country. They give them the power to arrest people for 7 days, and it can they can make it 60 days by orders of the court.
So you're saying that there really are no changes taking place at all, nothing significant anyway?
I don't think that the regime is able to change anything.
The Syrian government is claiming that this protest movement is an armed insurrection by extremists. Is there any truth to that?
For us, we do not trust the regime. Even when they make weather news on the TV, we do not trust this news.
Even about something as simple and straightforward as the weather?
We do not trust this regime at all. Not me, not the people.
Does the momentum of the current protest movement make regime change more likely?
The regime like a cancer. No way for medical. There's only one way. Make surgery.
Drastic surgery.
Yeah.
What do you see happening here? I mean, is that drastic surgery to get rid of the cancer that you're describing there, which is the Syrian regime, is that likely to happen, and how soon could it happen?
Like what happened in Egypt, like what happened in Tunisia, the same thing. Not like how it happened in Libya. We refuse to change by guns, by weapons, no. We do not want to see blood. Even till now, the regime attacked the people. We lost maybe through our situation since about a month till now, about more than 300 persons killed.
So no turning back now?
No going back.
Human rights lawyer and campaigner Haitham Mala, who's been jailed several times for opposing the Syrian regime, speaking to us from Damascus. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, too.
The fighting continues in Libya. Today, Senator John McCain called on NATO to step up its air campaign to help the Libyan rebels. McCain was speaking from the rebel stronghold of Benghazi in the east. But rebels have also been fighting in the west, in the mountains along the Tunisian border. The region is populated by Berbers, North Africa's indigenous people. Berbers are an ethnic group distinct from Arabs. They've long been viewed with suspicion by the government of Muammar Gaddafi. Now they've taken up arms against him. Marine Olivesi reports from the Tunisian border town of Dahiba.
With its flat rocky mountains and arid red plains, Dahiba looks like the Wild West, only a North African version of it. Refugees, rebels, and cars have been pouring into this Tunisian border town on the outskirts of the desert. 20-year-old Wassim has been driving back and forth between Tunisia and Libya. He brings food or fuel on his way in and news from the front line on the way out. Later today, Wassim heads back to the liberated town of Nalout in Libya's western mountains, some 30 miles from the border. The drive usually takes under an hour. That's when he can actually see the road. It's taking longer now. Wassim says he's been driving at night with his lights off so Gaddafi's forces won't spot him. He says the food, medicine, and other supplies he's carrying in his truck are a lifeline for the rebels. And he's prepared to risk his own life to supply them. Some 10,000 Berber rebels are believed to be fighting in Libya's western mountains. The city of Zitane, 60 miles from Nalout, was the first western town to rise up against the regime back in mid-February. Sifao says he's been waiting for this moment for a long time.
We've been so long against Gaddafi's regime. We need to keep the liberated zones. We don't want to lose this.
Like most people in the Nefusa Mountains, Sifao is a Berber. He says Berbers in Libya have faced years of discrimination and persecution under Gaddafi.
He never allowed us to speak our language. He never allowed us to talk free in the media or anywhere. He's not allowing us to give the names to our children if it's a Berber name.
Sifao says only a democratic regime would secure the rights of the estimated 500,000 Berbers living in the Nefusa Mountains. But he knows that Gaddafi won't give up without a fierce fight.
We expect everything from Gaddafi now. Everything. Gaddafi have a bad history with the Berber area from the beginning. He's looking at the mountain area as its enemy. They are bombing the houses anywhere. They're bombing anywhere, like everywhere.
Fighting has escalated over the past week in the mountain region. Gaddafi's forces have reportedly been shelling towns along the rebel-held zone. Some 15,000 Berbers from the western mountains have sought shelter in neighboring Tunisia over the past 2 weeks, according to the UN Refugee Agency. Thousands more are expected to follow now that rebels have taken control of Dahiba's border crossing, making it easier for civilians to evacuate. Omar Ali Zakari arrived a week ago with his wife and three daughters. His 18-year-old son stayed in Nalout to fight. Omar says Berber rebels have the upper hand now because they know the mountains every nook and cranny, and they're fighting for their own cause. The Berbers aren't afraid, he says. When we fight, we have only two options, win or die. For the world, I'm Marine Olivesi in Dahiba, Tunisia.
This is PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from the Medtronic Foundation, assembling the country's resuscitation experts to save more lives from sudden cardiac arrest. Learn more at heartrescueproject.com. Medtronic, innovating for life.
This is The World. I'm Lisa Mullins.
And I'm Katie Clark. You may have heard the parable of the Good Samaritan. According to the story in the New Testament, the Good Samaritan was the guy who helped out a Jewish traveler found beaten on the side of the road. 2,000 years later, the Samaritans are still around. They're one of the oldest and tiniest religious minorities in the Holy Land. Their community is split between Israel and the Palestinian territories. As Jews celebrate Passover this week, Samaritans are celebrating also in their own way. Reporter Daniel Estrin witnessed their Passover ceremony in the West Bank.
The sun is about to set over the hills of Samaria, deep in the heart of the West Bank. On the top of one hill, young boys and their fathers are dragging 50 very nervous sheep to the center of the village.
For us, this is a great event and happy event. But from the other side, it's very, very sad festival for the sheep.
Benjamin Tzedakah is a Samaritan elder with a white mustache, a sense of humor, and a deep devotion to his tradition.
We are just fulfilling the commandment of the Almighty, like it is written in the book of Exodus, chapter 12, 13, 14, and 15.
And the Lord said unto Moses and Aaron in Egypt, I'm paraphrasing here, tell the Israelites that each family is to take a lamb, and on the 14th of the month Nisan, they must slaughter the lambs at dusk, and they shall eat the flesh that night in haste. It is the Lord's Passover. This community says it's been reenacting the biblical Exodus every single year since the Israelites left Egypt and entered the Promised Land, exactly 3,647 years ago, according to the Samaritan calendar. As dusk falls, men cut the lambs' throats and smear a bit of blood onto everyone's foreheads. Everyone claps. The inner parts of the animal are burned, the lambs are roasted, and a few hours later, the community feasts, just like the Bible commands.
It is not Charlton Heston, the Cecil B. DeMille Ten Commandments movie. It is the real thing.
But what exactly is the real thing, and who are the real heirs to the biblical tradition, has been the subject of debate for centuries. Both Jews and Samaritans claim they descend from the biblical tribes of Israel, but there's one major difference. The ancient Jews offered their Passover sacrifice in Jerusalem. But Samaritans say God's chosen holy site isn't Jerusalem. It's Mount Gerizim in biblical Samaria, what is today the northern West Bank. Unlike Jews, they still reenact the Passover sacrifice. During the time of Jesus, these theological differences made Samaritans and Jews bitter enemies. And in the late 80s, during the first Palestinian Intifada, the Samaritan community in the Palestinian city of Nablus feared persecution and fled their homes. But today, says Elder Benjamin Tzedakah, both Israelis and Palestinians want to be the Samaritans' best friends.
The Samaritans became the only entity in the Middle East that respected by Arabs and Jews. And actually, they are making competition who will come to visit the Samaritans.
Who came to visit this year for the Passover sacrifice? People who usually don't mix. The Palestinian mayor of Nablus sat near a prominent head of the Jewish settlers movement. Israeli medics and Palestinian firefighters stood by the fire pits in case of injury. Palestinian police and Israeli army commanders shook hands. Jewish settlers and Palestinians and tourists from around the world were all there for a glimpse of this small community.
I think it's fantastic that there's such a multicultural diversity here in Israel.
Ilan Ben-Sion is an American immigrant serving in the Israeli army who was moved by the motley crew of visitors.
I think it's great that despite all the conflict that's been going on, particularly in this area, that things like this can still happen. And, you know, just in this sacred space, as they like to call it, people can mingle here peacefully.
Nearby stood Palestinian filmmaker Diana Alzir.
I'd have to say that this is like the only place where I would actually be in the same, let's say, neighborhood with settlers, Israelis, Palestinians, Palestinian security forces, Israeli security forces, and nobody's like trying to show their authority or like a power over you.
What do you think about that?
It's confusing.
The Samaritan community itself is also confusing. There are only about 750 of them. About half live in an Israeli town near Tel Aviv, speak Hebrew, and serve in the Israeli army. The other half are Arabic speakers who live here in the West Bank. They send their kids to Palestinian schools, and some even work in the Palestinian Authority government. And yet, the Israeli and Palestinian Samaritans gather together on festivals like this, as one community. Politicians on both sides seek to curry favor with the Samaritans as a way to stake their own claims to the Holy Land. Israelis see them as living proof of Jews' ancient roots, while Palestinians emphasize their centuries-old relations with the community as proof of their historical connections to this land. The Samaritans, for their part, say they don't pick sides. Tzedakah says they often host Palestinian and Israeli community leaders together on their holy mountain.
And they feel free to come here and speak about peace and also opening themselves to the Samaritan issue, which is the most important for us, because we see any activity as ensuring the existence of the community long time ahead.
There were 1.5 million Samaritans in the 5th century. 100 years ago, there were only 146. The community wanted to prevent inbreeding and to boost their numbers, so the high priest started allowing men to marry non-Samaritan women. Tzedakah's grandfather was the first Samaritan to marry outside of the community. And last year on Passover, for the first time, the high priest took another bold step. He welcomed a single mom and her 4 kids into the fold as individuals, without marrying in.
Let me introduce you to Sharon. Sharon, come in here.
Sharon Sullivan grew up as a non-practicing Catholic in Michigan. She admits that some in the community are still getting used to them.
There's a little bit of surprise on their part. What are these Americans going to be able to do here? And then I see sometimes they laugh and they're surprised when they hear my kids reading in ancient Hebrew.
This tiny community may be holding on to its most ancient customs, but it's also adopting new ones too, like welcoming outsiders like Sharon. Samaritan elder Benjamin Sadaka says with a smile that he hopes little by little the Holy Land's oldest and smallest religious community will someday number 1 million again. For The World, I'm Daniel Estrin, Mount Gerizim in the West Bank.
For today's Geo Quiz, go fly a kite. We're looking for a city in India today where kite flying is a cherished tradition. It's the largest city in the state of Gujarat on the banks of the Sabarmati River. It's also one of the world's fastest growing cities. The population is 4 million and rising. That makes for a lot of kites during the city's annual kite festival. Millions of colorful kites fly from rooftops throughout the city.
And you can imagine when you see any direction, it's absolutely just lush just seeing all these kites around. It was just everybody, rich or poor, Hindu or Muslim, everyone looking up at the sky with such wonder.
And it inspired a film called Patong that's just made its U.S. premiere in New York. We'll talk with the director later in the show, but first, try to come up with the name of the city in western India that goes crazy for kites. Clark, Kate Middleton will marry Prince William for love. Ahead, we remember dollar princesses who married British nobles for less romantic reasons.
The dollar princesses were a breed of very rich American girls, and it was as simple as that. It was cash in return for a title.
That story ahead.
PRI's The World is brought to you by the Medtronic Foundation, assembling the country's resuscitation experts to save more lives from sudden cardiac arrest. Learn more at heartrescueproject.com. Medtronic, innovating for life.
This is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. I'm Katie Clark.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. The reality of a strict and long-term evacuation of the area around Japan's Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant is starting to sink in. 6 weeks after the crisis at the plant began, authorities are threatening to arrest and fine anybody caught within the 12-mile evacuation zone. The World's environment editor Peter Thompson is in the studio with me right now with the latest. Peter, has there been a new radiation release from the plant that would cause government officials to say to residents, we're serious, stay away?
No, actually, there haven't been any significant new events at the reactors. Actually, in the last couple of weeks, things have kind of settled into what you might call a chronic emergency as opposed to the acute emergency of the first few weeks after March 11th. It seems instead that the clampdown, as you might call it, on access to the area came after the discovery of roughly 60 families still living in the evacuation zone and a lot of other residents sneaking in to fetch things. It's also a reminder, though, Lisa, by the government that there's still a real risk of new radiation releases until the plants are really brought under control, and as well that there's a real health risk from the radiation that's already there. Things may have quieted down in terms of the day-to-day events, but the government's making an emphatic statement that it's still not safe for any of the 85,000 people who've been evacuated to go back.
So what are the outlines of this new clampdown?
Well, the strict exclusion zone, as you said, is roughly 12 miles, and as of midnight last night, anyone caught entering that zone can be fined up to 100,000 yen. That's roughly $1,200. The government says it will organize bus trips into the abandoned communities. They'll let one person from each household go into their homes for up to 2 hours to collect valuables, but then everyone and everything coming out of the area will be screened for radiation. The government also says that no one at all will be allowed to go into the most highly contaminated areas within 2 miles of the plant.
So how long will this rule be in effect for the residents who obviously are eager to get back to their homes?
Well, yeah, people are incredibly frustrated, but unfortunately it could last quite a long time. No one's actually saying how long, but if you read between the lines, it's likely to be months, if not years. The plant's owners say it will be at least 9 months before they can bring the crippled reactors into what's called a cold shutdown. So the exclusion will be in force at least that long, but many observers are saying that's a very optimistic timeline, and it could be a good deal longer before we can reasonably be certain that there won't be any more radiation releases. And of course, no one can say yet when the risk from the radiation that's already there will fall to acceptable levels. In some places, it could be years. In some places, it could be decades.
Okay, so whether or not there's any more radiation, what's there right now still is unacceptable in terms of human health.
In much of that area, I mean, I think it varies from place to place, to be sure, and it will vary over time as well because there were different isotopes that were deposited and they have different half-lives and will sort of disappear over time, and that will differ from place to place.
But and then whether or not people are allowed back in sooner will hinge on that.
Yes. And also whether they're able to clean the area up.
Peter, before we let you go, any other news related to the Fukushima plant this week?
Well, one thing that I thought was really interesting in terms of the global impact of this disaster on the nuclear industry around the world, since the accident, a lot of governments have said they're backing away from their commitment to nuclear power. But here in the U.S., the Obama administration has said that it's still committed to expanding nuclear power, although perhaps with tougher regulations. But the market seems to be sending a different message. Yesterday, NRG Company, which had planned to build two nuclear plants in Texas, said it's pulling out of the project due to regulatory and market uncertainties. They also say they're not confident in the ability of their partners in the project to come through. One of those partners was the Japanese company Toshiba. The other was Tokyo Electric Power, which owns the Fukushima plants.
Peter Thompson, the World's Environment Editor, thanks.
Thanks, Lisa.
The pressure to get good grades at an elite American university like Harvard or Princeton or Yale can be overwhelming. But the pressure to get good grades at a top university in South Korea can be even worse. The Korea Advanced Institute for Science and Technology is a case in point. Four students at KAIST have taken their own lives in the past 5 months. Some critics blame a tuition system that penalizes students who don't get superior grades. Reporter Jason Strother sent us this story from the campus in Daejeon.
Members of the KAIST baseball club take the field for a quick game after class. The students here aren't known for their athletic skills. KAIST is the MIT of South Korea, and graduates are practically assured a job in the science and engineering fields. KAIST models its curriculum on American universities. Even the classes are taught in English. And that makes it tough for some students here, says a 22-year-old math major he asked to be called Chung.
Many students haven't experienced that lecture done by English, so when they first come here, they need some help.
Switching to Korean, Chung says what makes studying at KAIST especially stressful, though, is the school's unique tuition policy. Undergrads at KAIST attend tuition-free as long as they maintain a 3.0 GPA, but if their grades slip, they have to start paying. Tuition is $5,500 per semester. It's a financial burden on the family and a source of shame. KAIST says three of the four students who committed suicide didn't have the grades to get free tuition, and that's caused some critics here to blame the system for the deaths. They say KAIST president Seo Nam-pyo also shares some responsibility. Seo recently appeared on television and in front of lawmakers to apologize for the suicides. He promised to end the school's competitive tuition system. Officials at KAIST declined to be interviewed for this story, but KAIST Student Council Vice President Choi In-ho says the critics may not know the whole story. He says we can't say that the suicides were just the result of the tuition fees. Those students could have had other problems. But Choi says he thinks the current policy punishes students who are already falling behind and is glad to see it go. So is Kim Jong-duk, a chemical engineering professor at KAIST. He says Koreans have a deeply ingrained notion that education is the means to a family's social betterment, so students at KAIST and all over Korea feel enough pressure already.
Parents and school and society push them to have better scores in the academic achievement. They feel that if you get a high score, then family may feel that he may be hope for the family.
Several students I spoke with echo that sentiment, but a 22-year-old chemical engineering major who didn't want to give her name says her family doesn't pressure her.
I think the most important thing in my life is my happiness, not study.
For thousands of parents here, their children's happiness means taking them out of the Korean education system altogether. 50-year-old Seo Hee-jung decided to send her son and daughter to the U.S. for high school and college. I met her in a Seoul cafe. She says Korean schools are too competitive and students have no freedom, and she doesn't want that type of life for her kids. The Korean education system is focused only on studying, and only a student's grades are important, she says. There's no opportunity for a student to play sports or do other activities. I just don't think kids can have a happy life here as a student. At KAIST, the administration has announced changes that some students hope will make their lives a little happier and less stressful. Starting this fall, all students will be guaranteed 8 semesters of free education, no matter what their GPA is. Student Council Vice President Choi In-ho says it's a good start, but the pressure doesn't begin at KAIST. He says it's a general problem in Korean society. Whether it's in middle school or high school, students have the same stress. For The World, I'm Jason Strother in Daejeon, South Korea.
30 years ago, Diana Spencer married Prince Charles at St. Paul's Cathedral in London. One week from today, their first son, Prince William, will wed Kate Middleton at Westminster Abbey. Other members of the British aristocracy will fill the pews. And many of those aristocrats will have an American connection. You see, quite a few of them are descendants of American-born women. Those women were called dollar princesses. From London, The World's Laura Lynch tells us who they were and how they became royalty.
What a job getting all those yards of silk. What a dream she looks. What a dream she looks.
When Diana Spencer alighted from her horse-drawn carriage onto the steps of St. Paul's Cathedral, some saw the beginnings of a fairy tale.
And if you asked a little girl to draw a princess, I think she'd draw a dress just like that.
There may have been young American women back then who dreamed of being princesses themselves. What they may not have known is that there were princesses in the country's past, the Dollar Princesses.
The Dollar Princesses were a breed of very rich American girls who came over at the end of the 19th century to Britain and to Europe looking for titles. And it was as simple as that. It was cash in return for a title.
Daisy Goodwin has written a novel, The American Heiress, based on the lives of these women. Goodwin says newly wealthy Americans, like the Vanderbilts, had just about everything they wanted, except social status.
Even though the Vanderbilts, for example, had more money than anybody, they were as rich as Croesus, they weren't being asked to the nicest parties.
The solution lay across the Atlantic in Britain. Dukes and earls, struggling with debt and dilapidated castles, were looking for wives with multi-million dollar dowries. The Vanderbilt's 19-year-old daughter, Consuelo, married the Duke of Marlborough in 1895. Goodwin says she was one of the first to make the journey and the deal.
When these American girls came over, they were so much richer that they could hardly resist. And a quarter of the British aristocracy, a quarter of them married American money in the period between 1890 and 1910. And I would say it's no exaggeration to say that these dollar princesses basically saved the British aristocracy for a generation. I mean, they kept the stately homes of England going.
The phenomenon sparked a magazine called Titled American that Goodwin says was the Match.com of its day. The lives of the dollar princesses were closely followed in the U.S. press. British men found them vivacious and independent. But for all their fame and considerable fortune, Goodwin says they failed to make fans out of one group, the English women who suddenly lost their chance at nobility.
They'd kind of grown up from the nursery expecting to marry the Duke of this or the Earl of that, and that's kind of what they were trying to do. And then suddenly, their entire career prospects were kind of jettisoned by some American girl from nowhere, in their opinion, who came in looking lovely, but who had no idea about how to dress, what to do, how to hold her fork or whatever. And she would just pinch the most eligible bachelor from under these poor kind of English girls' noses, and they hated it.
I, Diana Francis. Take thee, Charles Philip Arthur George.
As in Diana's case, many of the dollar princesses ended up in loveless marriages. That includes her own great-grandmother, Frances Work, who was, in fact, a dollar princess. And so Prince William also has stateside ancestry, thanks to the American obsession with British class and status. In some ways, says Goodwin, it marked the start of Anglomania.
America had all the money, but Britain had all the tradition. And, hey, that's something that hasn't really changed, has it? You know, I mean, I would say that in America, there's probably more interest in the royal wedding than there is here, even. And I'm amazed by that, but I think it's rather wonderful.
For The World, I'm Laura Lynch, in London.
French riot police officers are not pleased about a new rule.
We have rules, and this is just for one particular class of police officers, and that's not fair.
Lieutenant Timothée Attarlé is a spokesman for France's largest police union, and he and his fellow riot police are angry. Here's why. They're no longer authorized to drink alcohol on their lunch hour.
Police have always been authorized to drink alcohol since the police was created in the Middle Age, but only during lunch break. Since 1989, we have a specific law saying that policemen are authorized to drink one glass of wine or a glass of beer during lunch break.
In fact, all public sector employees in France are allowed to have a glass of wine or beer during their lunch break. Even the packed lunches that French riot police get while on duty have come with an alcoholic option.
You can choose what's inside. So if somebody wants only fruit juice or water, he can have it. But the one who wants some glass of beer or of wine, he can have it also, because this is a rule.
But last fall, photos of beer-swilling riot police made it onto the internet. That wasn't so great for their image. And it prompted the new policy, no more wine or beer with lunch. Riot police are the only public employees affected by the rule. And Timothée Attarlé says that's unfair.
Our riot police in France have always been excellent. 5 or 6 years ago, when we had real riot problems, mobs in the street breaking, burning cars, our riot police always been efficient. Number of dead people, zero. Number of people who were injured, very, very few. So the problem of alcohol does not exist. There is no alcoholism, for example.
Still, Atarle admits it's not the end of the world.
It's not that important. We will not be on strike for this. It's no use. We just demand that for this case, just like any other, rules are respected. Everybody should have the same treatment.
And for Atarle, that means just a little glass of wine with your lunch. This is PRI, Public Radio International. This is The World. I'm Katie Clark.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. We've got our eyes on a new film called Patang that just had its U.S. premiere. Patang means kite in Hindi, and the film is set in the city of Western India that we asked you about in our geo quiz today. Prashant Bhargava directed this film. He's at home in Brooklyn, and congratulations first on the premiere last night at the Tribeca Film Festival. Can you tell us where the film is set?
The film is set in Ahmedabad, and it's the seventh or eighth largest city in India. And there's two parts of the city. There's an old city and the new city. The new city is full of the malls and the Nike stores and all of that. And the old city is a place that is very much run by a sense of faith. It's a city that's endured a lot of religious violence. And I'm always touched by their resilience and the sense of pride and happiness in the way that they move forward. And the architecture is very beautiful and a different way of life.
And that's where you chose to locate the film. What's the tie with the kite festival and Ahmedabad or Ahmedabad or Hamnabad, which is, we've heard it pronounced all three ways?
The kite festival takes place on January 14th, and it's absolutely a spectacle when you go to Ahmedabad. They fly a million kites. Everyone's on their rooftop. So they're made of paper and bamboo, and you can imagine when you see any direction, it's absolutely just lush, just seeing all these kites around. And so when I went there 6 or 7 years ago, and I had this small idea about doing a film about the kite festival, and I saw Ahmedabad, I just had to make the film there. It was just everybody, rich or poor, Hindu or Muslim, everyone looking up at the sky with such wonder. And for me, kites are very much like a meditation. Regardless of who you are, when you fly a kite, the thoughts and doubts that you have are forgotten. And it's almost like sending a message to God.
Sending a message to God, meaning what?
You're flying a kite and you're trying to get it as high as possible and cut each other's kite to get closer and closer, and in that meaning, you know.
And when you say cut each other's kite, how do they cut them?
The string is, they take ground glass and chemicals and some egg, and they mix it, and then they coat the string with this ground glass. And it's kind of, when my dad's time, when they would do it, they would crush light bulbs and old soda bottles, and they would put it on the string, so the string is sharp. And when you're flying the kites, you actually get your hands cut yourself.
Holy smokes. This is like, I was thinking it was a good kind of recycling at first, but now it's sort of brutal.
Yeah, it's like going to war and you feel very proud of the wounds that you have. So when you have two strings up there, you're trying to slice your opponent's string or your neighbor's string, and there are a lot of techniques. One is to let the kite just be carried with the wind with a lot of speed. And so if someone tries to cut you, you'll cut them. Another way is like you let the string go slack, so no one can cut you at that moment. And then the most artful way is the guys who can really dive the kite downward and pull very, very fast. And with that velocity, they can cut kites.
And the idea is to what, be the last kite suspended?
No, there are a million kites in the air, so there's no way you're going to be the last one. They fly very late into the night. But as any sport, like I enjoy golf or something like that, and when you hit a couple good shots or you cut a number of kites, it's just inside you. You go home dreaming about it. So there's a certain zone you get. And as an individual, you're just trying to cut as many kites as you can.
One of the beautiful things about the film is that it's taken from above and it's taken from below. And some of the shots are taken with a Super 8 camera that's supposedly being taken by the shots being taken by one of the characters.
One of the characters, Priya, returns with her father to Ahmedabad, and it's the first time that she's visiting after a couple years, and she really enjoys taking footage. And that was very much inspired by my research footage and shooting myself. So, for example, Priya finds a local boy flying kites really well, and he hasn't kissed a girl on screen, off screen. So we get his first kiss on screen in the film. So the film is how celebration heals. It's a family drama that takes place during this kite festival. It's just one festival. Like, we don't have something like this in the West where just everybody is celebrating. There's no alcohol. Just everyone's up on their rooftops, and they're just celebrating flying kites. And there's such joy in people's eyes, you know?
Congratulations on the film, Prashant Bhargava. His film, The Kite Patang, is now at the Tribeca Film Festival in New York through April 29th. It's about family and India's largest kite festival in Ahmedabad. The answer to our geo quiz today in India. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. भांकी भांकी है उठान है उम्र भी जवान लागे पतली कमर बड़ी भली रे.
Now, from the movie theater to the dance club, music from the group Delhi to Dublin closes our show today. The Sextet's new release is called Planet Electric. First off, Delhi to Dublin is not from Delhi. It's not from Dublin either. The band is actually based in Vancouver. It's the musical influences from India and Ireland that give the Canadian band its name. Okay, we admit it. This track doesn't sound especially Indian or Irish, but listen to this one. Delhi to Dublin is set to start a short U.S. tour next week. You can check to see if the band's coming to a city near you by going to theworld.org.
Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. The World is produced by Andrea Crossan, Joyce Hackle, Carol Hills, David LaValle, April Peavy, Adeline Sear, Tracy Tong, Amy Bracken, Marcus Raitt, and Carol Zoll. Ann Lopez is our director, assisted by Catherine Griffin. Our editors are Ken Bader, Jennifer Gorin, and Aaron Schachter. William Troop is senior editor. Chris Wolf is news editor. Our London staff includes Rob Hugh-Jones, Ian Rosser, and Rahul Jogbekar. Our managing editor is Jonathan Dyer, and the executive producer of The World is Andrew Sussman. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Lisa Mullins. You can join us online at theworld.org. We hope you have a good weekend.
PRI's The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Radio Boston. The World is supported in part by the National Science Foundation, where discoveries begin. More information at nsf.gov. And by the PRI Program Fund, supporting informed risk-taking in public radio programming. PRI Program Fund contributors include the Ford Foundation and Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees.
PRI, Public Radio International.